Thank you, Ilkka. Just a quick show of hands to begin with. How many of you play free-to-play games? Shame on those who don't. And how many of you actually pay for free-to-play games? At least occasionally. And finally, how many of you are already like working with games or and the rest of you, I understand, are going to. So my name is Ville Heijari. I've been working for a year now with a company called Playhaven. And in December 2013, Playhaven merged with Contagion. So Playhaven makes marketing tools for mobile games and applications. Contagion makes analytics. And now our plan is to build, merge these two products, so we have like an analytics platform that then allows you to also combine marketing automation based on the user data. I'm not going to talk about our product, but today I'm going to talk about the trends when it comes to analytics, marketing, monetization within applications. A bit about the history as well, a bit about the overall landscape. And I know that you've already had a number of lectures, and probably a lot of what I'm going to talk about has been touched already. I hope that I can bring like new angles and some new ideas here as well. At any point, feel free to interrupt me, ask questions, voice your opinions, call bullshit, anything that you may wish. Yeah, feel free to do so. So just a couple of words what I used to do before. So before I joined Playhaven, I was working for Rovio, leading the marketing team for Angry Birds. And I joined Rovio in 2010 when Angry Birds has already had like 6.5 million downloads, and it was like starting to take off in the summer of 2010. And back then the world was very different. So GDC, Game Developers Conference 2010, in March 2010, that was like the sort of pivotal moment of clarity for the industry when Neil Young, the CEO of a company called NG Moco, he held a big lecture talking about free-to-play. And basically, like he sort of tore open like all of their games and how free-to-play monetization changed their life and changed their company entirely. And he went on to sell NG Moco for a Japanese company called Dina for hundreds of millions of dollars. So obviously, like there was a lot of worth and value to be explored in free-to-play. But still, the overall landscape was very different. So, for example, you had with Rovio, you had a couple of games out there on the market, and the business was built largely then on creating more games around that brand and cross-promoting those games and selling all these games for 99 cents. And of course, if you sell hundreds of millions of downloads, hundreds of millions of applications for 99 cents each, you're going to make add up a lot of value. But then, of course, like there's also like a sort of limit of how many applications you can cross-sell and how much are you then like extending and building the brand through meaningful collaborations. Then how do you innovate? How do you go beyond? And for example, in case of Rovio, Rovio is now trying to break out of the mold of that 99-cent business and go into free-to-play. And if you've been following that particular company and, for example, Angry Birds Go, their real first like proper free-to-play racing title, it launched in December and it pretty much peaked in top 20. But never really broke top grossing. Never really broke into like the really top grossing elite of the games. And repetition, why is free to play? Why is it lucrative? Why does a company like Rovio go from the paid application to free to play? Is that in free to play, you used to have like the amount of money, the price point, and the audience, the maximum audience you can reach. And in the apps case of app stores and application marketplaces, the price went down to the lowest bracket to be able to reach an audience as wide as possible. But then when we're thinking about free-to-play, we're sort of eliminating that box. So anybody, theoretically anybody who is in the audience, in the target audience of that game, could be spending any amount of money on that game, theoretically. And of course, like as of today, when we look at like the top 10 most top-grossing applications on iOS today, This list is mostly like has mostly been stagnant for the past 6 months at least. So you see like the same big publishers stick in the top grossing lists because they are the ones who are also putting more emphasis on user acquisition and retention so that they will stick there and generate more revenue. And these are the companies who are making like up to millions of dollars a day in revenue, and that's on Apple alone. And of course, like this is a very, again, like a very fickle market, because for example, King has had like for long has had like a sort of unstated ambition of aiming for an IPO and getting listed on the stock market. And for example, as of the day before yesterday, the Telegraph was already writing that King has put IPO on hold, because there was no news on their IPO in this time frame, contrary to the analysts' expectations. And then of this afternoon, King has filed for US IPO. So basically, there's a lot of rumors, a lot of speculations of whether any single company can sustain their business and profitability on, like, for example, an insane success like Candy Crush Saga. And of course, King has introduced more games, is marketing them really aggressively. If you look at that top 10 grossing today, they have 3 games in the US top grossing chart, top 10 on iOS. And obviously, like these, when any of these companies files for an IPO, you should definitely go and dig out their filings with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, because these filings contain pretty much like all the data points for the first time in public, how their business is faring, how their business has been doing in the recent history, and how they expect it to do in the future, and these are really good sort of benchmarks and guidelines on what to look for and what to expect. For example, this is a bit small print. I just did a quick screen grab like 2 hours ago. But like King's year, 2011, the total revenue was $63 million. 2012, $164 million. And 2013, $1,884 million and some spare. So obviously, like this gives us like a pretty good impression of... Yes.
Yeah. Do you think Rovio is going to follow that same?
Well, Rovio doesn't have like a super successful free-to-play game out on the market. Like Angry Birds Go is really like their first proper free-to-play title, and they pretty much launched that in December. So this is King racking up revenue for the entire duration of 2012 in basically like top 1 to top 3 ranking. In the top grossing chart, and you really can't catch up with that in 3 weeks.
Just one question about that: if you examine it a little bit more,
yeah.
So, do you have any guess how it's possible that even though they had like 1.8 billion,
yes,
revenue, they had only less than 700 million?
Yeah. So actually, I'm not sure about the cost of revenue, like whether that includes like the Apple share and so on.
It includes Apple shares, and it's about 30% of the revenue.
Yes.
The cash flow was only 1/3 of the revenue.
So then you go to sales and marketing.
Yeah.
And sales and marketing in King's case is $376 million.
Yeah.
So that's, if you take Apple share away, you get to $1.3 billion. You take everything else, that's a couple of more... hundreds of million away, and we get like close to $1 billion, and then we have $376 million in sales and marketing. So basically, like the sort of general wisdom on the market has been that anyone with a successful top 10 grossing free to play game is spending approximately 15 to 35% of their revenue on back into user acquisition to sort of keep feeding that beast and finding like more paying customers. And here it's like very literal, like that 376 million, that comes close to that like upper bracket of 35%. Of course, that's just a sort of rule of thumb in the industry. You could be spending anything. Like if your average paying customer, average revenue per customer is $10, why not spend like $9.90 acquiring those customers if you can make sure that you can get that 10 cents of profit out of every customer? Of course, like then you can start thinking that is this very sustainable that you're paying like super premium per customer? But then that's another discussion. Okay, but yeah, let's go into some 2014 trends and best practices. So I'm going to start about discussing data. And big data and analytics in particular, how they like affect our ecosystem, what we can do about like getting more data, more valuable data, and using it on marketing actions, and then go into some case studies of actual marketing actions and what the results have been in different mobile games. So 2014, we've sort of as a company, we've labeled it as the year that the big data becomes actionable. So basically, data analysis is a main driver for every like online and digital service. How do people use the services? What actual like parts they do? What actions they take? And this is like a sort of in this industry, we sort of have the luxury and privilege of really seeing like almost real time of what do the users do, how do they consume the product. And so why is this a trend? Well, it's basically like also comes from like the biggest sort of influencers in the industry. For example, Eric Schmidt from Google, he said in his year-end predictions, the biggest disruptor that we're sure about is the arrival of big data and machine intelligence everywhere. So the ability for businesses to find people, to talk specifically to them, to judge them, to rank what they're doing, to decide what to do with your products changes every business globally. So pretty much like games, mobile applications, services, anybody who has like some kind of digital interface and feedback channel to their customer can utilize that data, that usage data, and change and optimize their products and provide more personal experiences. And So what is big data? Well, this goes to the simplest definition of Wikipedia, that big data is the term for a collection of data sets so large and complex that it becomes difficult to process using on-hand database management tools or traditional data processing applications. And the challenges with big data, we're talking about so much information that the challenges include capture, curation, storage, search, sharing, transfer, analysis, and visualization. And of course, like these are all we can resolve. So basically, if we think about capture, when we're just sort of critical enough what to capture, we're not capturing like sort of unnecessary junk. We just get like our essential business data. And if we're thinking about like cloud solutions, any kind of modern like service infrastructure, storage shouldn't be an issue. You just add like sort of more Amazon nodes or whatever. You can always store more data. It's only like when it becomes super massive that it starts to become less economical. And then the bigger these data sets become, it becomes like harder to just mine them. So you need specialist tools to really make queries to find specific information in these data sets. And then if we think about sharing and transferring, the data itself, that's not so much a challenge. But then, like when you derive information from that, how do you really like share what this data is saying about your business, which sort of then connects to analysis and visualization? Like, okay, I get this bulk data about my game sessions, my players completing goals, using items, so on, whatever. What does it mean? What does it mean in conjunction to monetization, to time spent in game, and so forth? So more often, when they talk about analytics, they often just come back to like daily active users, average revenue per user, and so on. And these numbers by themselves, they're sort of vanity metrics. So they tell you really nothing about what's happening. They tell you about the scale. They tell you about the reach. But they really don't tell you anything about the real actual health of what's happening in the business today. So basically, and they don't help you. Like having an X amount of users today and this much more the next day, how much are going to retain? and how is your business going to grow? So this sort of individual metrics don't help you estimate and predict the health of your business a month from now, 2 months from now. So that's when you then need really like the data analysis. And data analysis is not individual numbers, but it's exploratory and it's visual and it's how you present like where your business is going to be. Just like as a quick visualization, if I have an X amount of LinkedIn contacts and you come to me and say that I need to hire a marketing guy, I can just go and like if I remember someone's name, I'll find them from my contacts. But then there's like also means to like map like who is doing what, who is in which industry, and sort of start exploring what are these people actually doing. And this is like a LinkedIn visualization of data sets based on just like connections, industry, how are different people connected. So it's fairly simple data. But when we're talking about games and big data, so games are simple, right? So why would games like, why do they necessitate big data tools and management? Like how can games generate big data? Well, first of all, if we think about where the data is coming, here's like really basic product telemetry from a game. A funnel analysis of level completion. This would be something that you especially do in product development, soft launching a game. Soft launch an arcade game with 30 levels and see how many people complete how many of those. 100% of your users complete 100% of the levels, you have either an amazing game or it's like far too easy and simple and so forth. And of course, if you have like a significant drop-off somewhere, there must be like some kind of hang-up. Again, maybe it's not interesting, maybe it's too difficult, maybe there's a bug, maybe it's wrong, maybe you can't proceed to the next level, at least on like certain devices or so on. But if you think about that, you're getting like this kind of data points per level, and if you're measuring then like individual goals within a level, individual interactions, objects, so on, you might have like already like a couple of dozen data points for sort of a simple gameplay analysis. And then if you think about doing this analysis while running a live game for millions and millions of users, you're capturing an insane amount of data from every gaming session. And this is then just the gameplay. This is just how your game functions. But then you get to the player behavior. How much money are these players spending? What's the location, device language, first session, last session, date, total sessions, time spent in game, which OS version, game version, hardware, are they on Wi-Fi, 3G, and so forth. So why is then this data necessary is that this is how you analyze your user cohorts, your user segments. For example, how many users do you have from China? Does it make sense to localize your game in Chinese? Are they spending any money? Should you show advertising to the Chinese audience and maybe like promote in-app purchases to the US audience if they're spending more money and so on? So to have like a like more educated idea and assessment of your users and build segments out of them. Again, like this is an order of magnitude more data compared to the product telemetry. And then when you think about, okay, monetizing your game, you start thinking about ad networks, sort of CRM on how do you manage your customers, any other like sort of communications, marketing tools, email marketing, and so forth. Today there's more than 1,000 digital marketing technology products out there. And of course, a fragment of this only applies to gaming specifically. But you could be used like a number of analytics tools for different purposes. You could integrate number of advertising products, some kind of customer service interface, different APIs. Again, like generating more data. And I'm a simple guy. I like simple analogies. So in this data, why do you want to make sense of this? I think about something like this. So it's cartography of what your game is, who's playing it, who's the competition, where it is like on this map. Like in medieval times, these cartographers, when there was like unknown waters and treacherous places, they used to like take some artistic liberty and paint some beasts there. Because it was dangerous to go there. And it's the same in product development. What you don't know will kill you. So you make assumptions that I'm going to make this game for audience X. They'll probably like it because I played it with my friends and they said it's amazing. So let's invest hundreds of hours into developing something. So do you want to test it and do you want to verify it with data or do you just want to base it on assumptions? And like today, it's relatively easy to put together a quick production cycle and to put things out in limited markets, be it Finland or New Zealand or Indonesia or wherever, and test them. Verify your hypothesis of, is this game fun to play? Does anybody want to play this more than twice? So with all this data, the challenges of big data are capture, storage, sharing, and so on. But if we think about it, it's not really like the curation and transfer and sharing. If those we can all solve with technology, but how do we take it into action? So when you have your analysis, when you have your whether you are the business intelligence guy or you have another business intelligence guy, you have some kind of data analysis, you have somebody looking after monetization. These are all becoming like increasingly more merged. So it's not that like, you know, somebody, some other guy from the next floor or the next room brings you an Excel sheet and tells you to somehow interpret it and make changes to the game. But how do you enable this kind of environment where you can dynamically do stuff? Like if something doesn't work in the game, you can dynamically A/B test it. You can test different variations. You can drive different content, or if it's something that you then actually need to make proper changes into the product itself. At least you have like your product information, your product intelligence. You have your business intelligence sort of side by side, so you don't have to like go between different products, different dashboards, different reports, and sort of try to piece together like what should be the next step. So the concept of actionable data has been like in sort of buzzword map last year and this year, and what it really means is that how do you bridge that gap from having all those numbers, having all those reports, and having them like as easily accessible as possible to relevant people in the team, in the organization. To really like take action immediately and not sort of get lost in just reporting and interpretation. And of course, like you could say that this affects like bigger organizations the most. Obviously, like if there's more and more data, more and more people trying to make sense of it, it gets more complicated. But the same is true for smaller teams. If you're an agile small team and you still want to make intelligent, educated decisions based on data, actual relevant data, you don't want to spend all your time. Actually, you probably, the smaller the team, the less you will have time to go and look at different sort of data points and cross-referencing them. So how can you enable something like this? You need clearly defined strategic KPIs. So what are the main key performance indicators in your game that really, really drive your business? Like, for example, like when you're just developing the product, if you have a problem with users not understanding how to play the game, how to use the product, you will have some kind of huge drop-off in your level completion, in your gameplay analytics. And then probably like you could, as a solution, you could introduce, for example, a tutorial. Here's how you play the game. Go here to build this building, click here to speed it up, click here to finish it. We've all played some of those. So then one of your metrics becomes like how many people, when they downloaded the game, how many people completed the tutorial, how many people then finished level 1, finished level 2, leveled up, and so forth. If these are like your strategic KPIs, it's on your responsibility to really, really define like which of these are the crucial ones that you need to measure. And then when you're doing analytics, you need to instrument them equally carefully so that the data you get is not corrupt. Again, you're not measuring like technically the wrong things, and you get it as real time as possible. Then sampling versus complete data. A lot of analytics programs, sort of services and platforms, they offer you like the option to either capture everything and then look at it, and of course that's a shit ton of more data, or then maybe you can sample it at like relevant times, at peak hours and so forth. So you only sort of take a slice of the data. A problem with sampling obviously, like, it saves a lot of cost. It saves a lot of, there's less data to manage and analyze. Your analysis process might become faster. The problem there is it gives you like this sort of broadcast overview. If we're thinking about our business, the business we're in, if we make free-to-play games, first of all, we have a limited number of users. We have a tiny percentage of that user base actually spending money, actually being like the super engaged players. And then we have a tiny percentage of those people actually spending a lot of money and being like the biggest customers and so on. So it might be that you might lose out on some of the most valuable data of usage of your product. So that's a consideration, like whether to capture everything or whether to just sample, sort of taking like a snapshot of the data and seeing what's the usage like. And then of course, like, data has to be available and transparent. So if you're building a team, your organization grows, you have like separate functions you have a game development team who then liaises with the analytics team, and maybe you have like some kind of monetization guru who sits completely separately from everybody else. Don't build silos. Like, break down every possible barrier for sort of data exchange. So everybody who is critical to making this kind of product decisions, where they increase value for your business, should have like a ready access to the data, so that you don't need to like go and apply for something to get access to somewhere. Of course, this can be a risk point, as we saw with Supercell a few weeks ago. If you make everything really transparent in your organization, somebody decides to hack your organization, they also have access, probably pretty easily. But I would still argue that it's much more valuable for your business to have basically allow everybody access to all the data possible. And of course, it needs to be connected. The data needs to be connected to the necessary processes and tools to accomplish the finding people, talk specifically to them, judge them, rank what they're doing, decide what to do with your products. So when you have like everything to interpret the data to get the results, how do you turn them to action? What is like the actual, if you need to send, let's say you need to send a push notification, hey, like to your Labs players, you need to send you need to enable some kind of guidance or tutorial or something in the game. Where does it happen? Like, do you interpret the data and then go and change your product, or can you enable it online? And there's several different customer relationship management tools, different communications tools that allow in-game messaging, notifications, and so forth, for example. So sort of establish like where the data is coming from, and how do you, like, in principle, what do you need to do to make it actionable? So what's in the essential like toolkit? What do you need? What kind of tools, what kind of interfaces do you need to get all this data? First of all, I've sort of identified six here, and I will just go through them quite briefly. So product telemetry, again, whether it's Flurry, whether it's Contagent, whether it's another analytics product, Localytics, Mixpanel, so forth. This is like the what's like what goes on like in the sort of cockwork of your machinery of your game. When you're developing your game, what are the drop-off points? What are the hang-ups? Where are the technical problems? Where can you help the players? Where can you make the experience more gripping and more fun? And this is mostly like this is the most useful when you're actually shipping product. So when you're launching a game, when you measure it, that is it working? Like, what do I need to do? Do we need an update? And so on. Actually, this is something that you don't want to run all the time. You don't want to go and revisit. This is something that you should be then like sort of verify that my game is running beautifully. There's no obstacles for new players. So you shouldn't be like shipping product every week. But you should use the soft launch period. You should use like some kind of like limited testing phase where you make the product sort of as finished as possible. Because then when you get like more and more users into the game, what you then want to do is start analyzing the behavior, analyzing their value, and looking at, okay, how do we optimize the monetization? How do we optimize the value in the long term? How do we enhance like the long-term lifetime value of those players? Product telemetry, acquisition. And acquisition, it's all about user growth. So basically you have your paid acquisition sources, you have social media sources, Facebook, Twitter, so forth, you have ad network, and then on the other hand you have the app stores, you have different cross-promotion tools, and where's the traffic coming from. Here the big challenge is like how do you solve this sort of mess of what are the valuable traffic sources. Now, advertising network fragmentation, it's quite the pain point. For example, when I was working at Rovio, we were planning to launch Angry Birds on Android. And at that point, the Android market itself, like the device fragmentation was insane. There was like cheap devices that wouldn't even run the game. Then there were like high-end devices where you could have provided like even a much more richer experience and everything from between. So to add to this, back in 2010, Google Play didn't exist. It was like the predecessor Android Marketplace. Google Wallet as a payment method wasn't there. It was a Google Checkout, which was much more clunkier experience. So you couldn't really like target the game to the devices, and on top of that, nobody was really spending any money. So then the solution there was to, let's just put it out. It's free. It has advertising as monetization. If it runs on your device, you know, it's free. You get your money back if it doesn't. So basically like trying to provide as good a service as many a device as possible price point where you can't really like contest the value because it was free. And back then it was as easy as looking at which are the ad networks really generating like enough fill, have enough inventory to really run advertising to monetize this on a large scale. And there was really like only one answer. It was AdMob. AdMob back in 2010 was running like sort of enough volume to integrate a single ad network to be able to generate a lot of revenue over a large audience. Nowadays, it's a bit more complicated, and especially on the acquisition side, how do you verify like where is your game exactly getting the audience it deserves from? So basically, how do you know that you know running video ads on AdColony or Wangle isn't more valuable to you, even if it's more expensive, than running like some kind of acquisition campaign, just advertising on Facebook or an acquisition campaign with Fixu or so on. That sort of takes us to the next pain point, which is attribution. So no matter where you acquire users from, you can have tools to attribute the value, attribute the user source and attach a value to those particular users. So basically, the background for attribution as a sort of separate piece of this puzzle is duplication. So it used to be so that you had all those ad networks already, and an advertiser wanted to buy a user. So you don't know which network you're going to get the most users from. You need a lot of traffic, so you advertise over a lot of networks. And the problem would be that when you get an install, if I was a player and I had clicked on any of a number of ads and then finally had clicked on a single ad on any given network which led to the install, all of these networks would claim it just based on like a sort of postback from the advertiser. And Here, of course, like if I'm advertising for a game, I don't want to pay three times over for a single user. So it was costing a lot of money to people who were doing really active performance marketing. So the solution then was attribution. So basically, industry standard rules: the ad click leading to the install, that is the advertising. That is the one who gets the advertising money from the advertiser. So basically, two ad networks. One ad was clicked 4 days ago, but the player didn't install the game from the ad. But when they clicked another ad on another network 1 day ago and installed the ad, the attribution SDK will, there's a number of those products also available, the attribution SDK will then attribute that install to this partner. But that's a nice bit for the advertisers. You're not paying double for various networks. And you know which network your traffic is coming from. So if that guy came from NextAge and that guy came from InMobi and this guy is spending more money, you want to spend more money with NextAge than InMobi. So there's sort of three components here. So what attribution enables you to do is to sort of predict the LTV, the lifetime value of players coming from any given network. So basically, the only thing that the attribution does is it cleans up the source. You know where the player came from. You identify the user. Then you need some intelligence there to really analyze their behavior, how much money they're spending, how much time they're spending, how many levels did they complete. Again, what are your crucial KPIs? Do you want people who stay with your game a long time? Do you want people who spend a lot of money? You can analyze and measure all of those things and then predict the LTV per user acquisition source. So you can optimize your spending on user acquisition thanks to attribution and by the kind of players, the kind of traffic, the quality of players you want to. If you want to like just you know, reach the top of the most downloaded like free app charts, then of course like you go for the cheapest source without caring a world about how much money you're going to make. But if you want to go for maximum lifetime value, maximum money spent, maximum total engagement of these players, then you need to analyze the sources carefully. And again, if we go to the top 10 most grossing applications, They're really like driving this. So basically, think about this as a funnel where you acquire a large number of people and you try to retain, obviously, as many of them as possible. And retention is usually where we have the so-called K factor, where you know, people, loyal players, bring in more loyal players. Like, I'm playing Clash of Clans, why don't you also like start playing Clash of Clans and join my clan, and then we attack people together or whatever. So basically, this is like where you get your viral user sources, organic growth, and you get your paid acquisition, advertising, so forth. Then when you simply like look at your monetization actions, how they're working, how much money you're making per user, and what is this sort of viral combined LTV and combined acquisition cost. That then enables you to really make the decisions on where should you be buying more traffic. If you need more valuable customers, then you need to enhance monetization so you can make more money per customer, so you can invest that again in buying more valuable customers. It's easy. And then engagement. So here, like, the game content is obviously the key. Something like Angry Birds had an insane retention when sort of introducing new levels, new themes, new content, new birds. You had like a ridiculous retention on existing players. The only problem in that mechanic was that it wasn't really making money. It was more of content marketing. Keep providing more content for that 99-cent initial purchase so that those people will then go on and, you know, spread the word that here's a game that provides an insane amount of content for a really, really cheap initial purchase. But nowadays, you need to be a bit smarter, especially if you want to keep people then spending money for more content. And you probably can't, again, like the smaller your team, the smaller the business, you probably can't be publishing more content all the time, every week. Maybe you want to, like a monthly, 3 week, monthly, 6 week, 2 month cycle is really nice if you can bring like new episodes, new gameplay elements, new characters, and so on. But in the meantime, you really need to be just driving like sort of simple engagement actions. Like, how do you reward people for coming back every day or at least every week? Give them different rewards. Enable some kind of prizes, discounts, and so forth to keep them coming back. And this is something that you don't need to hard code things like this into the game. Think about these as advertising is simple HTML5 interstitials. So can be these. So these can be driven dynamically online. And then retention. Retention, of course, is infinitely valuable because when somebody keeps playing your game, keeps spending money, you're not spending anything to keep them there, right? So think about sort of retention as if we think about the fact that I think right now the statistics is that like around 22% of people in any game. When they install it, whether it's from an app store or whether it's through an ad, 22% never come back. They only like look at it once, and that's like a good result because at some point it was like around 85% of people who only like launched a game once and never opened it again. So if you can keep coming back like for more than one session, for more than one day, that's already a big win. And think about all the other traffic that you're buying into. Addition to that, retention is just money in the bank. It's a saving activity. And then if we think about that sort of like how difficult it is to capture a player's attention that they want to come back to your game every day, then there's also again tools like how do you reach players when they're outside of the game. You can have them, like, for example, sign up on an email newsletter. Email marketing, it's not very sexy, but it still works. And I've seen, for example, email newsletter campaigns for game updates and new game launches and so on get, like, up to 30-35% click-through rates and, like, conversion rates upwards of 15%. Yes.
What's the policy with Apple with collecting email accounts? When is it allowed and when is it not?
First of all, you have to be with Apple. You have to be COPPA compliant. So COPPA, the Children's Online Protection Privacy Act in the U.S. and then the Safe Harbor legislation in the EU, they mandate all data collection and privacy regarding like minors, I think under the age 13. What a lot of people are doing nowadays with any social features, even Facebook Connect, email newsletters and so on, you need to have some kind of age gate. So a lot of people are putting like, for example, like simple puzzles and so on and age verifications. I think there's, for example, EA just released a game called Dungeon Keeper on iOS and Android. And on Dungeon Keeper, a very controversial title when it comes to monetization. But they have, like, for example, I think Facebook-enabled chat, or maybe it's on their own server or so on. But if you want to go to the chat, you have to give your date of birth. Okay, if you're under 13, the chat will you're blocked from the chat. How they have implemented is that you can then go back a step and give another date of birth. So it's not like at least they tried. So at least they put like a sort of minimum safeguard in there. But this is of course complicated. But this is something that we as anybody who is in the development and in this industry has to address in some way. We actually have a tool. We at Playhaven, we worked with a number of companies who make games like exclusively for children as well. And we worked with Nickelodeon on a bunch of their children's titles. And we made like an age gate thing where any cross promotion, any marketing tool is like preceded with a simple maths calculation. So you have to be able to read the numbers and do the simple calculations before you can access anything. And that wasn't even done like before any COPPA or Safe Harbor regulation. So there's like these kind of responsible companies who think about the reputation and the user experience anyway, who want to take like a proactive stance on this.
Okay, but you're allowed to do a pop-up like that says that.
Yes, if you have like the age gate there as well. So basically, in here, you could, for example, you should have another field in the form to confirm your date of birth, and basically if the date of birth if they're under 13, you can't store it. And then of course like email is something that's fully outside the game, but then there's push notifications. So push notifications we know can be sort of tied into the game actions. Like for example, let's say that there's a timer in the game, you're playing Candy Crush, you're out of lives. You get a notification 10 minutes later, 20 minutes, whatever later, that your lives have been filled and you should come back and crush some more candies. But they can be more. So they can also be segmented, targeted to different portions of the audience. They can have like more value than just saying like, hey, your animals miss you, like come back to the farm. Push notifications can be also used to guide people to claim their rewards, to get like special discounts. You can have like whatever. If you have a holiday promotion in the game, you can have a push notification that also like takes people back there. So they can be more creative and when they're really effective, they can drive a lot of traffic and always when it's more relevant, when it's more targeted. That's when all of this messaging is more effective. And finally, in the toolkit, I think that this is like the correct order to discuss these, always discuss these things. You need to first acquire the users, then you need to figure out like how are you going to keep them playing, like why are they interested in your game, and sort of monetization comes last. So if you get the users, you will be able to monetize like one way or another. Monetization, of course, like it comes from in a free-to-play game, and it comes from game design. It comes from the game game content, and you probably heard like from game designers lecture before me, like how to make efficient loops and how to like enable monetization in the gameplay. So on technology side, it can come from many things. So advertising. Advertising is, of course, like the biggest monetization source. If we're just looking at technology, but here, like the technology is enabling you to monetize. There's different payment solutions, virtual currency solutions, offer walls, a lot of ad networks. There's rich media ads. You can nowadays, like right now, video is really big. So, video has proven to be like a lot more efficient than the static interstitials in converting new users, getting more downloads, and it's also more valuable in monetization. So video ads tend to generate right now much higher eCPM, so much better advertising revenue than static interstitials. But then some people are already pushing for this. There have been different rich media ad units available for quite a while now, but one thing that people are experimenting right now is this playables. So basically, like, let's say King was advertising Candy Crush in your game, and instead of a static interstitial, you get like one level, one small 3x3 level of Candy Crush where you like complete the level, and then that takes you through to the download. People try to make like more engaging, more interactive, more interesting ad units all the time. Whether it's like worth investing in yourself, advertising is a game where like the creative part has a huge significance. Like one banner might perform 30% better than another banner, even with like exactly the same product, just a different creative approach. But then again, like creating a rich media ad unit of your game, that takes time, that takes resources, that costs money. Whether it's that much more efficient, that's again like something left for testing, and should be again like data driven. Of how much time are you investing in advertising? So, but anyway, you in advertising you always have like the supply side, which as a game developer, as somebody making money, is you. Because your game, your sort of KPIs towards advertisers are how many people do you have, but it's not really about the unique users, it's about how many game sessions do you run every day, and how many impressions, advertising impressions, can you show in those games. That's what's interesting to the advertisers and the ad networks. When you plug in an ad SDK, And then you realize that, holy shit, that I have like 10,000, 15,000 daily unique users, but I'm not making any ad revenue. You're not driving enough sessions. You're not driving enough ad impressions for those ad clicks to really convert in the sense where you'd be creating enough value. And that's also like why it's going to be, you want to go to the ad networks and say like, get me more valuable advertising so that I can generate more revenue out of my small inventory. But the ad networks at the same time, they have people who are running millions and millions of impressions and sessions every day. So advertising really is a volume game. If you have a small game, you could have like 50,000 daily unique users. It's probably smarter than if it's a free to play game. If those 50,000 loyal customers convert well, or even convert mildly, it might even make sense not to use advertising at all. But then, of course, how do you increase that conversion? You might have like special offers. You might have discounts to your paying customers, and so on. So that's the real challenge. How do you take how do you storage? How do you transfer? How do you interpret the data? But then, how do you solve this puzzle? How do you take the telemetry? How do you take all the data from your advertising metrics, advertising performance, monetization performance, your most valuable acquisition channels, which you have attributed? How do you take that data, and when your product is running, when your product is finished, don't go and touch the product, but how do you dynamically manage each user's experience sort of along the way in the game? So basically, like, if you have a drop-off in your game, for some reason, and it doesn't affect, like, for example, all the users, it's somewhere there you see that you lose like some segment of players. Maybe you lose all the left-handed people. I don't know. It can be like something that's completely unanticipated. But still, like, you don't have to go and change the entire product. Maybe you have like, you know, some kind of information that you can provide dynamically that will at least alleviate the problem. Make it like less of an impact to your business. Do you have any questions at this point? Anything?
What's that?
Yeah, so how do you sort of enable the data capture even from a, from the real, really, really beginning of a project?
Yeah, would you say that some of these tools would apply to that?
Yeah, and of course, like if you think if you go even like to the sort of simplest level of paper prototypes and having like some kind of focus group, play around with your paper prototypes or so on. Of course, like then the tools for that is just like hands-on, like focus group user testing. You put a video camera up there and you record what they're doing and then you take notes. But as soon as you, let's say you then say that, okay, our concept works on paper, let's create an HTML5 minimum viable product and put it out on a browser and have like more people play it. Let's make like a really simple, skin it really simple, let's make a really simple game out of it and put it on Kongregate or wherever, what's the best platform online to get people playing it, then you should already have like some kind of measurements in place. And obviously like this, what I describe is like sort of the sort of matrix, the puzzle of plugging everything in. Like the sort of more coherent platform you can think of. I think that you have to sort of think in like a contingency of that, okay, if I'm going to need like the product telemetry for product development today, I am going to need the monetization tools and so on tomorrow or 3 months from now. So that like it's good to sort of think that like this is not enough, that what do you need for the like the end final product and the end package. You don't need to enable everything from day one, but how do you plug it in? Like, can you find like a platform that's enough for your product where you, when it becomes more complex, when you add like different elements to it, when you start thinking of acquisition, for example, that you can just like switch on new pieces and new sort of data sources in there. But if you like, let's say that you make your own data analytics for purposes of measuring 3, 4, 5 things. That works for you, but how do you then plug in, like if you, let's say, your main monetization model becomes integrating a half a dozen different ad networks, for example. Do they all talk there? Can you plug them in there? Do you have the time to develop dashboards where you monitor yourself, like all those networks and so on? So, I would say that even when you're in the paper prototype phase, you should sort of pay at least like a minute of thought to like how are you gonna measure different things and how are you gonna lay it out in the longer term.
Do you know if the companies do they sort of go up to the market and get some metrics even if they only have this like really simple MVP, or is it more common to actually think of the game and then go out and see what happens?
I would say that like nowadays it's commonplace to even when you put the MVP out, you get at least like the basic metrics of retention, of usage, of time spent playing and so on. Because that's how you then validate whether it's worthwhile to go and develop it further. And of course, like I'm only talking about like data-driven development and business. If you want to make your game that you enjoy making and love making, then data can help you, but if you don't want to base your development, your design on data, then that's a different story. Yeah. Yeah.
But maybe it's not really so. The other industries have already taken out some of the things that before people thought that you couldn't take that out. You need to develop into a product. But I don't know if that happens if the competition isn't that fierce yet that you actually need to do this, that you go out.
Oh, it is. It is. And especially if you try to like raise money, if you try to like build something up from scratch and raise like venture capital, like you yourself said that like taking a product to beta might cost already like 50,000 euros, whatever. If you don't have that 50,000 euros, you have to somehow either you have like some sugar daddy who really likes your concept sketches or something and is willing to go on that. But I would say that it's much safer. You're much more like plausible to get some proper venture capital if you have the numbers to back it up that, hey, I actually have a concept that will have traction. All right. But yeah, like then setting this up, like data becomes one of your biggest assets because that's like the knowledge of your users. That's even if your product fails, you're collecting like a huge amount of valuable data of how do people spend time. If like let's say your monetization failed and your game didn't make any money, but you had like a ridiculously high engagement and retention on like the core loop of the game, when you go to make your next game, this becomes like hugely valuable findings and validation for at least like part of your design and your thinking. But then this is a huge investment, this infrastructure. And I'm not saying this because I work for a service provider in this industry. But the fact is that, and this is, by the way, Google's data center in my lovely hometown of Hamina, and this is only the cooling pipeline, so this isn't even the actual hardware. So basically, big companies are thinking that, okay, data is valuable, we have our data, we want to own our data, so we want to set up our own analytics because nobody offers the granularity we need to really measure what we want whenever we want and so on. But this can add up. Developing something like this can take a number of years. You're going to end up having like 12 people working minimum on 12 engineers working on something like this for a year or two, and you're going to end up spending a lot of money. So this is like a... I think that like building the infrastructure should be a similar approach as your other business. Like, what is the return on investment? When you're thinking about like setting up your own analytics infrastructure, building it up from scratch, developing your own backend, putting together your own cloud solutions, everything, and then what's the return? How do you recoup that investment? And most commonly, you can think that, okay, if I'm taking all this effort to build this up, then I can offer it to other developers for a fee. But then so do like all the service providers in the industry, and so does every other developer who's developing their own backend. They're thinking exactly the same. So it's a hugely competitive field as well. And I would say that like in Finland, we can find like server architects and we can find like a database expert and so on to work on this. But if your business was based, for example, let's say in San Francisco or Silicon Valley, there the industry becomes like super competitive. So you won't even find the people to execute something like this because they're already working for Google and proprietary like data companies, or Oracle or wherever. But yeah, building the infrastructure, another business development that should be dictated by data. Is it worth your investment? Is it really like worth the focus of your company? But why does this then like, let's say you make all the provisions, you put together an infrastructure where you're measuring the right things with the right tools, and they're nicely tied into the right tools to take action. So you can see that, okay, I made, there's like a dip in revenue, and I can see from here that it's because my advertising revenue has gone down, but I can refocus and use different advertising networks to drive it up again. When you enable a chain like this across like all of these functions of acquisition, monetization, so forth, you're really aiming for the win. And this kind of process, compared to like just looking at things separately and changing one thing at a time in one interface or one dashboard or wherever, or changing the product, this just brings more efficiency across the whole process. So your decision-making process becomes more educated when you have more access to a broader set of data. All of this use of analytics and reports becomes more effective when you're not cross-referencing a lot of different data, but you have everything at hand. And content creation becomes more economical because when you have access to the data, when it's there like right in your face, you know what you're supposed to be doing. So you don't end up like trying to fix the problems, but you're acting on knowledge. You're acting on all the signals there. And what's the most important part? the user experience becomes more personal because you're addressing actual facts. You're addressing user behavior that you measured. So it becomes more personal. It becomes more engaging, hopefully leads to better retention and so forth. As you can see, this is like a quite the field of different things. If we think about even like acquisition and attribution as an example, those two things you can spend a lot of time optimizing. And then if we think about then the post-install activities of keeping the players, retaining the players, keeping them really engaged, this can all be super time-consuming. It's much too much work for one person. But the ability to act on all of these sort of phases of the user lifecycle based on data, it's enabling then something much better in the future. So this is some of this is just like sort of predictive fluff, but this is like why the industry is heading into this direction, that when we're enabling much more thorough use of data across the whole product lifecycle, user lifetime, we're of course like creating more tasks, sort of more micromanagement, more communications per user. But what can we do then next? How can we make this better from there? When we enable it, how do we make it better? When basically like why this is based on data is because predicting the future is incredibly hard. What's going to be the number one game in 2015? And here's a good example from the turn of the 19th century, where a French artist like envisioned what a school will look like in year 2000. So there's a professor here crunching big data and beaming it into these pupils' heads. And you know, in a way, like this is you could think of this as e-learning or something, that like the concept is there, but the execution is a bit different. And this relates directly to market behavior, market analysis of how consumers will, what the consumer needs and wants will be, let's say 18 months from now. And here's a good example. In 2007, when the iPhone launched, an agency called Universal McGann, they conducted a global media study where they interviewed 10,000 people. And they came to the conclusion that there's no real need for a convergent product in the US, Germany, or Japan. They tried to estimate how successful will the iPhone be in the Western world, in emerging markets, and so on. And their findings indicated that nobody wants to buy an iPhone, because everybody in the US, Germany, or Japan who is an affluent consumer already has a really nice digital camera, they have the best cell phone money can buy, and they have iPods. So why would they buy another like mediocre product that combines like these into some kind of whatever? Whereas like people on the emerging markets were ecstatic, like, hey, like I can only spend so much money, so if I can get it like all in one device, that's great. But of course we know what happened. It became like much more of a word of mouth status symbol, like iPhone when it came out, it was like the Apple Mac crowd designer's phone, before it then like became just a standard, like sort of really commonplace smartphone. But it's the same when we're developing games. We don't know. We can't go to interview 10,000 people and ask what kind of game exactly do you want to play, and they will say one thing, and then when you keep developing that game, they're busy playing Flappy Bird, and you just had like no idea what happened to the market. And our sort of again, like it's a luxury that we can measure and see what people like, what they're most engaged with, and respond to that like almost in real time in product development. We don't have to think about that, what the hell are people gonna like 18 months from now. We can look at like what is like keeping them playing right now and respond to that. And we can make predictions based on their behavior to like 4 weeks from now, not like 6 months, 18 months from now. And these predictions can be pretty accurate. So we like to think that like 2015, next year already, we can make a lot of this process automated. So this is a bit ominous. This is like a Terminator way of saying it, that big data becomes autonomous. But basically, like when we model big data, when we when we do like data mining queries and start modeling user behavior, we can get to like an automated process where we programmatically acquire users from different sources, bucket them per their lifetime value thanks to attribution, and then as they proceed in the game, they get served with a different experience. When they're non-paying customers, maybe they get shown advertising somewhere along the way. If they're a paying customer, they sort of automatically go into a promotion cycle, which should never be like something that's like made to milk the paying customers, but which should be more of a, think about it as a loyalty program. You're spending money, you're enjoying the game, so you get added bonuses, you get exclusive content, you get discounts that other people don't get. But then to not have like you or somebody else pushing that button and enabling these campaigns and content and so on, this is the end goal, to really like automate this process, automate these actions. That's like the sort of nice starting point, is to make the big data actionable and aim for automation from there. Any questions at this point?
Why did you say like that feature?
It has hairy developers gathered on this monolith of wisdom, so they're evolving to the next level. So this is like sort of the second portion. So some of the sort of lifetime value thinking here, and then look at like a couple of case studies of what kind of results developers have driven, like using sort of segmented approach to doing marketing actions with their users. Like the players, they don't just like come into the game and play the game and that's it. But with a free-to-play game, it's a service. It's a life cycle. They play the game, they get more engaged with it. Some of them spend money on it, and then they exit the game eventually or go to another game. So where do you find the players? How do you keep them engaged? And how do you bring them back after they left the game? And as we just looked, there's so many things how you can measure these things, and then what kind of mechanisms you build to then actually bring them back, how to enhance, maximize this time and value that they spend with your game. That's a different story. Something like Rovio, built on paid applications, built on cross promotion, going to free to play. Free to play is where the value is. And anybody hazard a guess of what this number is? 400,000 to about 1 million. Anybody?
Per day.
Yes, so this is the daily installs required today to reach the number one iTunes App Store rank for free apps. So that's... And you need positive reviews for that as well, because there's an algorithm that takes into account like whether your application is crap or not. But it fluctuates quite a lot depending on what's on offer and day of the week as well. People are much more engaged, much more active on the App Store during the weekend. But let's say you're doing user acquisition at $2 a head and you want to be number one free application any given day. That's a big investment. So obviously, where we want to focus is then retention, keeping as many players as engaged as possible, and spending money. This is a really tough game to really go there and try to get to number one on paid acquisition alone.
This is actually
US. So the big question then becomes like, what is a customer worth? Like if it's like a ridiculous amount of money that you need to spend to be on top of those charts, if you want to be on top of those charts, what are those customers actually worth? How much money should you spend to acquire and to retain these customers? Retention can also be costly, depending on what kind of actions you take. And of course, like good old days, you could look at this as costs. And if your costs, development costs, marketing costs, were smaller than the revenue you were generating, you're profiting. Premium business model, where you have the price of admission, you have the single purchase, And most importantly, all the customers are equal. So basically, you're addressing broadcasting to like a sort of homogeneous mass of audience, and those people who are part of your user segment, who are interested, they pick up on your broadcast and pay that singular price. And today, customer no longer equals transaction. So customer becomes a relationship. So in free-to-play business model, you have a period of time and you interact with each customer who plays your game to build a relationship. Then we start closing in on this customer lifetime value, LTV. And how do we measure the LTV? You can actually like do a lot of really interesting forecasting just based on mathematical functions. So, for example, in traditionally, you know, let's say you're running a coffee shop and you're serving like a number of customers who are coming back a number of times and spending an X amount of money on product. So you can then start forecasting a remaining customer lifetime over like their life cycle. And then next, you can start forecasting the future revenues based on estimation of future products purchased and price paid. And then you have an estimation included of costs for delivering those future products. And then finally, you can calculate the net present value of the future amount. And like, if you ask me, like is this something that you should be, is this an exercise that you should be spending your time on? I don't think it is like in this extent. So you don't have to be this guy to think about like how do you want to build relationship and engagement on your customer base. It's not like like when we're talking about measurement, it really comes down to boiling your analytics down to those key performance indicators for your business. So that you're not entangled in some kind of like really like trivially detailed calculations of what might it cost to get new users 6 months from now and how much you might extract from those users specifically. So you're building a relationship as a marketer, and relationship is communication. So how do we want, when we're customers, when we're playing games, how do we want the publisher, the proprietor of that business to treat us? So we want to have like a nice two-way communication where we have a nice relationship, we get a good overall service instead of having like some kind of one-way street where something is being pushed to us all the time on a loudspeaker. So then we become closer to user segmentation. So if we want to be the guy on the left, and if we want to address the guy on the left, how do we make sure that we're speaking to them and we're not giving them the experience here on the right that we want to avoid? So addressing different people with different relevant messaging. How would we group people? How do we define segments if we want to customize our marketing messaging, notifications, communications? How do we group people? So basically, it boils down to customers who do something, act in some way, spend some amount of money, and so on, tend to do something else. Customers who spend a lot of time with your game tend to spend a lot of money in your game. If you can equal like this kind of behavioral patterns, you can divide your users into segments, into different user groups. And this understanding like these segments and what kind of people these segments consist of, where do they come from, it really helps you better serve your customers. So not all of these players are created equal. First of all, they come from different cultures, they come from different geographic regions, all of which have like different characteristics, whether it's just something as simple as language, but it can also be what kind of devices are prevalent, what kind of mobile devices people are using, is Android dominant or iOS, are people using more tablets or more phones, like where is the value coming from, how much money are these people spending on, are they spending a lot of money, are they part of like your tiny core of players who spend a lot of money, a lot of resources on the game, or are they just casual players? Are they somewhere in the middle? And then there's also the function of time. Is like a person who's spending maybe more time on your game and inviting friends to it to play it, is that person more valuable to you than just an individual customer who's spending a lot of money in the long term? So again, come back to these like variables of how do you group people into user cohorts, into user groups? Like people who start playing, if your game has been out now for 6 months, and it's gone through like a development life cycle of monthly updates, for example. People who download it today and start playing it today have a very different experience than people who played it 6 months ago. They have a very different set of expectations of what's coming next, what kind of content, what kind of experience, how are they going to spend their money on. Somebody who started like playing the first iteration on your game, they basically like had like some updates to look forward to, and they were spending like resources on a limited number of things and then waiting for you to develop more things. Somebody who starts playing your game now much later, they have like ton of things that they can purchase, and it's going to take them a lot of time to get and resources to get there, so they even have like a different expectation of how the game's going to play out for them. So not only like demographics, but also user cohorts. When did they start playing the game? Did they already lapse and come back to the game? Is this like a sort of somebody who's giving the game a second chance, and so on? All of these people have different behavioral patterns. And just like, you know, just in like some general statistics from the market, people like Fixu, Distimo, App Annie, they give out a lot of relevant data. They give out like monthly reports of the state of the app market on iOS, on Android. They give out like tidbits of information on how the best titles are performing. But also stuff like like this. Like these are pretty general statistics that 95 to 99% of customers never make in-app purchases. Are you going to ignore that fact and focus on the people who actually spend money? Or do you also want to, like, you know, provide for some sort of monetization mechanics, advertising, something different for this part of audience? Up to or more than 50% only play once and never return. How do you get them back? How do you give them? How do you sort of pull them in if they just tried it and made a snap judgment, but they still might be interested? Is it possible to retarget them and get them back in? Non-payers play mobile games roughly around 4 hours per week, and high spenders 12 hours a week. So there's a huge, huge difference there in time spent on games in general. And of course, if it's a high spender spending a lot of time on games, you want them to spend that on your game and not the next guy's. So for example, Distimo and App Annie, and then a user acquisition company called Fixu, yeah. So those guys, they put out like pretty much like monthly or monthly newsletters and a lot of infographics and so on. A lot of different usage data and just general like app intelligence. And of course, like when your business grows big enough that you want to do like a thorough competitor analysis. These are also App Annie, Distimo, they're also companies that give you like a really, really detailed insight on how your competition is doing. So they have like a lot of analytics on app stores alone. How many downloads are being how many downloads of each game are there all the time, over time, and how much revenue those games are estimated to generate. When we think about segments and this player life cycle and lifetime value, we can think of it as this sort of engagement curve. And of course, like this curve will change a lot, like radically, depending on the player segment and how they, what's their behavior in the game, what's their purchase history and activities and so on. So, for example, let's say that the paying customer comes into the game. So day one, when they download the game, They start from scratch in terms of like engagement. An engagement value here, this is just a simplified graph of sort of compound time slash money spent on game. And then over a period of time. So a person comes into the game, downloads the game, and we remember that like majority of players might not come back. It's that one session, that one chance you have there. So maybe you can reward them just for downloading the game. Like, hey, thanks for checking this game out. Here's 50 free credits for you. Like, go crazy. Of course, a point of controversy is here. Like, how do you capture the user's data on the very first session so that if they never try it again, if they even forget about the game, you can reach back out to them? And it's like, you know, if you go on a first date, you don't ask the other person to change their Facebook status that, hey, now we're dating. So it's like a point of controversy of how much can you ask? Like, do you want to, like, hey, you just downloaded the game. Now sign up. Like, now give me your email. Now log in with Facebook. And it's usually a good idea to give it like somehow ease the player into the fact that that there's like a bonus or some kind of boon for them to sign up and register with the game. There's a lot of different publishers, like for example, like Dina and Mobbage, where they have like a mandatory sign-on, like create a profile before you can even try the game, and we can be pretty sure that there's a big drop off there with any casual players already. So when you have the player sort of eased into the game with rewards and so on, if they start spending money, making purchases, then you should focus on like how do you, again, like not like how do you milk the player, how do you extract the highest possible dollar value, but what's the best service for a paying customer? Is it discounts? Is it some kind of special offers? Some kind of exclusive products, content, gifts. And at some point, of course, like the engagement with the game as well as the spending will peak eventually. It might be like further in the future, nearer in the future. They might not get that engaged at all. And it starts to go down. So I play the game for 3 weeks and I spend a lot of money on my second week in the game. I spend some money on my third week, I'm on my fourth week, and I don't intend to spend any money. Except, if I get like a super special offer, if I get something that's just like too good to pass, if I get something exclusive, something new that wasn't there before, that might nudge me again to spend more time keeping more engaged with the game. And then eventually, when I'm not spending a significant amount of time or money with the game anymore, then it's a good idea to cross-promote other games. So if you have more than one game in your portfolio, cross-promote your users to another game where you can then hopefully like you have the chance of resetting like this curve in another title altogether. And then monetizing with ads when there's no spending at all happening. And of course, like for somebody who's not spending any money, you might start monetizing them with advertising from the fifth session or the third day or so on. A lot of people do very aggressive monetization on ads. So you download a new game, you fire it up, you haven't even started your first session, and boom, there's an interstitial ad for you. For me personally, that's just like bad form. Like what's like? Is your game is not worth playing, so you're already cross-promoting me to another game. So it's always a good idea, like not to go too aggressive, not to go like overboard with the advertising. But then again, like now we come back to like what are the KPIs of advertising business? Number of sessions, number of impressions. If you have a lot of downloads, and for every download, you might think it's cynical, but every download, everybody opens up the game, that's one session and that's one impression in the bag. So it's again like every time you see somebody do it, you download a game and you see an ad on the first session, that's somebody really, really cranking up and maximizing on their advertising revenue, because those ads, they also convert. Okay, so if if the secret here is to, during the whole lifetime in the game, to have meaningful and targeted messages for the players, what is a meaningful and targeted message? And that, of course, depends on the segment. So for somebody who's not going to spend any money, they just come for like freebies and so on, they get a reward. And that's something that keeps them coming back, keeps them playing. And the value of those customers is then virality and them potentially spreading the word, getting you more players organically. For a big spender, it might be that discount campaign. They came back because there's like a weekend offer that they get 50% off a purchase that they've been like sort of waiting to make. And of course, this kind of like premium offers, they're not for everybody. Like somebody who never spent any money on the game, they're probably not going to spend $10 or $20 just because you have like a special one-time thing. But then somebody who's habitually spending weekly, monthly, I like to think of it as good service. That if you have like a special offer, it's a question of balance. Are you offering a good service, or are you exploiting the player? And I think that like anybody who's designing this economy, who's looking at the behavior of the users, can really balance this out. What's a good service? Think about it as, like for example, like an airline. You fly a plane to New York, you get air miles, you get points. You can get free. You can get like use those points to add value. You can upgrade your next flight or so on. So I like to think of like providing discounts, providing this kind of value for paying customers in a similar way. You know, think of it as a loyalty program, and not as like maximizing your revenue. Yes. That's a very good question. So that's like a point of contention where some people say never offer discounts because you will teach people to wait for discounts and they will only like make those purchases at that lower price. And then a second point is that do discounts add to retention? Do they improve retention? Or do they actually decrease retention? Like does the perceived value become lower? There's, for example, in these glue games where this gold is a hard currency, the gold is soft currency, but then they have like glue coins, which is the hard currency. Like the logic dictates that if you sell people hard currency, they're much more plausible to come back to spend that hard currency. It's like anybody who had an Xbox Gold Xbox Live account here, you had those Xbox points, and they were sold at increments, which made it impossible to like spend them to zero. So you would always like be buying more Xbox points to sort of fill the gap to buy a new Xbox Live game. And it was like supremely annoying to have 700 points hanging on your account and not being able to spend them on what you want. I mean, that's like one sort of strategy there. But then again, you could think of that as, is that then like exploiting people? Then like in the discount strategy, you can think that like, what is it that you will discount? Is there always going to be like, for example, like money only IAPs, or always going to be like hard currency items where you only like discount certain types of things? So I think that this is again like depending on the game, this is a point for experimentation and analysis. And that what I just mentioned about the retention, like whether discounts improve retention or decrease from it, there's from a couple of titles, there's like a bit of different evidence actually, that in some cases discounts could be seen like as sort of jumping the shark and saying that okay, that this game is just now not valuable anymore. But in some cases, like discounts are seen as extremely favorable, and people buy a discounted item and come back more than they did before. So did you had Aki here from Grand Crew, and Aki I think has a very nice elegant point on free-to-play design, that free-to-play should accommodate for whales. If there's like a whale, somebody who likes to spend a lot of money, and if they can afford it, why not let them? But your business should never depend on exploiting the whales or leaning on like those consumers and those users who spend like huge amounts of money. First of all, it can be seen as extremely unethical. And secondly, when those people finally decide to go away from your game, you're dead, because they are, if they become your main source of revenue. So here's like some tips and best practices from our users. Like, how do you then spread out? How do you engage like your entire user base effectively? These are like things that different developers have used and have actually seen move the needle for them on the revenue side. So for example, like that IAP strategy and discounts, there's a developer called Mobile Deluxe. They make slot machine games, social casino games, and so on for iOS and Android. And they did a discount campaign where they segmented their users according to their spending. So non-spending customers, people who had spent a low amount of money, some more, and then like the big spenders who have spent like upwards of $50 and so on. And for each of these segments, they drove like differently scaled discounts. So the lowest tier non-paying customers got like a $3 value pack for 99 cents special offer. And then the highest spending customers, everybody got like a significant 25-30% discount depending on the size of the package. But everybody got like sort of the appropriately scaled purchase. And what happened was that, first of all, of the non-paying customers targeted, 50% of them made their first purchase. So they saw that the discount and one-time only offer, and 50%, half of the non-paying customers converted on that special offer, made their first purchase. And overall, across all of the segments, they saw like an average of 175 to 250% increase in purchase conversions. So basically, if you're offering 25 to 30% discounts and you're effectively doubling your sales, That's in my opinion, good mathematics on this strategy. And here, like, the considerations obviously are, as you said, is this affecting like then the future purchases negatively or positively? Is this affecting engagement positively, negatively? These are then things that when you're thinking of discounts, when you're thinking of this kind of tiered strategy, you need to measure this and probably. You can not probably. You want to measure it according to each tier. Where do these discounts apply? Like, did those first-time purchasers, did this lead to then a second purchase at the normal price or at another discount price, and so forth? This is like for people who say that like that this doesn't like, let's say, talk in sort of absolute terms, that this doesn't work, that this isn't valuable. I like to think of like a comparison with online retail. Think about e-commerce. Why do we do price comparisons online? And how does, like, for example, like Amazon? You go to Amazon and you look at the product, and it shows you that, hey, you can actually buy this product used at a cheaper price, or you can buy it from Amazon Marketplace new for a cheaper price. So this kind of thinking, where you actually get offered like something that you're already looking for. This is not like reinventing the wheel. This is just games and these in-game stores as our sort of medium and marketplace on this. So this kind of thing should be driven by data. So you do campaigns, you see what works, and you act accordingly. You understand your users better. And if you get negative results from something like a discount campaign, then you never do discounts again, or you do them in a different fashion. And then secondly, building relationships outside of the game. Email marketing, as I said earlier, it can be effective. It's not like the hottest topic ever. I think that like why it's still significant and why it's even like probably more significant than before is that if we look at something like Facebook, maybe like 3-4 years ago, it made sense to build community on Facebook and really like trying to gather those page likes and people on your page. Because you could post on that page and probably most of those users could see those posts. But not so anymore. Now you pretty much have to, if you want to reach like even 15-20% of your page likes, of your community on Facebook, you have to pay to promote those posts. And even promoted posts are then competing with other promoted posts in those users' news feeds. So Facebook, in my opinion, in gaming has become much more of a user acquisition platform in terms of advertising in the newsfeed, but less effective as a community platform. It's good to have there, but it should like reflect all the content that you're creating and promoting. Whereas like an email newsletter, it might not be like the absolutely most effective communication channel. You might not get like huge conversion rates there, but at least that's still personal. And when you're sending out an email newsletter, you can measure how many people opened it, and you have like very accurate data of reach and how many people like opened, engaged, and clicked your messages, your communications. So Sega, for example, Sega used this kind of like data gathering tool where they asked people to sign up for a newsletter to keep up with Sonic games in mobile. And they had a game out called Sonic Dash, an endless runner. Oh, sorry, Sonic Jump was the first game. And they asked people to sign up to this email newsletter, and they got hundreds of thousands of sign-ups. They increased their total reach on their users in mobile 66% in this like mobile arcade category. And when they launched Sonic Dash, this was like their first point of communication, sending out a notification on email to all of these people to go download the new game. And if you think that their overall reach, I don't know what it was exactly, but it was like around 500,000. If you convert those people at a 10% open rate, 20% click-through rate, maybe 10% conversion rate, they have 50,000 downloads for the new game like that. And sending out those emails costs peanuts compared to acquiring 50,000 users at cost from mobile user acquisition sources. Fish Labs is actually an excellent studio, ran into a bit of financial problem. They were acquired by Koch Media, but they're finally this year coming out with this game called Galaxy on Fire Alliances. Pretty ambitious game. It's like a massively multiplayer online hardcore sci-fi strategy game for iPads. So that's quite a mouthful. And if you try to do paid acquisition for a title that's this niche, like if you would go now, you would launch a game today and go acquire users. It's much cheaper, it's much easier to acquire users for a racing game, for an arcade game, for a first-person shooter. If you have a mid-core strategy game, you have fantasy and dragons, you have spaceships and explosions, it gets much, much more difficult. Because how the advertising networks work in gaming especially, games tend to be promoted within genres of games. So if you play Endless Runners, you're going to see a lot of ads for other Endless Runners. Because obviously you're playing Endless Runners, you enjoy more playing more Endless Runners and sort of arcade games. So then something like this gets advertised to mid-core strategy players who are already like super engaged with those titles. So it's a much bigger leap for them to download that game, and therefore you get a really low conversion. So you're going to spend a lot of money on getting a very, very small number of users out of acquisition networks. So they turn to cross-promotion. They have like a sort of AAA value space shooter simulation called Galaxy on Fire. And they've got like 90% of their I think 30,000 plus beta testers for this game just from in-game messaging. So they send out in-game messages and notifications in their existing games, and hey, we have a new game coming out, it's in soft launch, we're doing a closed beta, So come and download it from here. Okay, then you have to figure out like how do you manage the distribution of the beta game to the beta testers and so on. But again, when they launch the new game, they're going to launch it, of course, like through the app stores. They're going to have tens of thousands of beta testers who they can communicate directly with, and again, have tens of thousands of free downloads on day one for the new game. So basically, again, lowering user acquisition costs by finding the right channels where to get the people from into the game. And then push notifications, it sort of touched already on the fact that like it's not all just your animals miss you and your lives have been fulfilled or somebody's attacking your village. But relevant push notifications can drive up to 50% of daily active users. So this is usually measured in like 24-hour period. Of course, like can't really tell like how many people of the sort of long tail would have launched the game anyway. But what we've seen is up to 50% of daily active users of a single game came to the game, launched the game by acknowledging a push notification. So how can they be relevant? First of all, they can be targeted, again, according to user segments. So, for example, think of a push notification as a sort of reactivation tool for lapsed players. So you think of your players in segments and cohorts. Somebody who downloaded the game 3 weeks ago, played it really actively, had a lot of weekly sessions, daily sessions on the first week, second week, third week, spent a lot of money, but they haven't played for the last 5, 6, 7, 8 days. So why did they lapse, and how can you reactivate them? And they're probably not going to reactivate by a notification saying, like, please come back. But what if you can actually, like, give them some kind of relevant content? Like, for example, like there's a discount waiting for them or a reward where if they actually activate, acknowledge the push notification, they get gameplay content, they get a reward, they get something special for coming back. And again, like think about it that you're not like sending a push notification for everybody every hour every day to come back to the game, but only target those cohorts, those lapsed segments, like people who were super active but for some reason haven't come back for a while. Maybe they just sort of maybe they're actually deleted your game and they're not there anymore, but maybe they just sort of for some reason found another game and didn't, almost forgot to come back. Maybe you still have the opportunity to activate them. And why is it valuable to try to reactivate them, again, is cost. The cost of sending a single push notification, the cost of sending a single email, it's minimal. It's tiny compared to cost of paid user acquisition. Then rankings and ratings, these are calculated nowadays since last autumn into App Store. This applies to the iTunes App Store on Apple App Store. Rankings and ratings are calculated reviews and ratings are calculated into the App Store rankings. So basically, if you get like huge virality, you launch Flappy Bird and it becomes a huge success. If everybody, it gets a huge volume of downloads in a short period of time, but everybody thinks that this is crap and gives it a 1-star rating, it's gone. It's not going to be there. It's not going to probably even go to number one, and it's going to sink really fast because of those poor ratings factoring into the actual results. So another strategy that you can do here is, again, segmentation. Who are the people, who in your audience is most plausible to give you the most favorable ratings? And that's probably your most engaged biggest spending, most involved players and customers. So it's probably not somebody who spends dozens of sessions every week on your game who's going to say that, I hate this game, it's ruining my life. But if they're saying that, they're still going to give it 5 stars. Like in the case of Flappy Bird. Did anyone actually play it, though? What's your high score?
12.
12? Interesting. 65, but I'm on Android. And then again, like coming back to this example, keep the content relevant. So again, for somebody, a good game experience is getting discounts. For somebody, like not really like getting like how to do something, how to achieve a goal in the game is ruining the game experience. So you can give tips, you can give, like find those segments, like find what's blocking people from keeping really engaged and try to resolve them, not by reinventing the game and making huge change into the game mechanics, by giving advice, giving like relevant messaging and information to the players. And generosity always works. So my favorite like example of generosity was when Spotify was launched. It was really hard. It was actually, you needed like an invitation to get into Spotify, but it was like the end of the rainbow. There was like free music. And when it was launched, there was no advertising, there was nothing. But it spread like wildfire because it was exclusive. So everybody wanted to get in, submitted their email, signed up to, like, give me invitation now, give it now. And then they started, like, sending out, like, huge batches of those invitations. And as we all know, eventually they got tens of millions of paying customers out of that user base. And you could argue that the same logic applies. Like, people come back to Angry Birds time after time just because there's free content, there's more levels, there's more stuff to play for free. Like you paid 99 cents for Angry Birds, you're still playing it a year and a half ago because there's new episodes, new cool free stuff. What if you're not spending on a free-to-play game? Why do you come back? Like, maybe you get like some allocation of currency, maybe you get some freebies that still keep you interested in it, and eventually might even lead up to you actually spending real money, actually buying currency in the game. So again, like giving stuff to good customers, to loyal customers, to engaged customers, it could prove to be a valuable strategy. And of course, keep in touch with people. Get their email addresses. Get them to like your Facebook community, sort of, even if you're not reaching all of them. You're making like a connection where you have your players come to you and you can reach them through email, through Facebook, through Twitter, through push notifications, through different channels, sort of maximize the opportunity to find them when they're not in the game or when they're lapsed for some reason. So what's a customer worth? Really depends on the game, depends on the individual customer segment, but still, if we're not putting a dollar value on it, we can say that they have many different values. They have like a value of spreading the word of mouth. They have a dollar value of their spending, but they're really worth of this relationship. And the relationship is worth what you invest in it. If it's a good relationship, even if you're not making a lot of money, you're going to have a lot of advocates saying, like, you have an amazing company who makes really cool games. You're the friendliest people on earth. You have great customer support and so on. So understanding the customers, learning how to best communicate them, how to find, identify those different segments and serve their needs, and how to cater to like somebody who wants more content, somebody who wants more communication, somebody who wants more instructions, information. That's it. Thank you very much.